From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
East Bay, El Cerrito.
West Oakland.
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up, we take a tour of California natural life. First, diving under the bay waters to meet some unwelcome guests who are here to stay.
And if this boat travels to another location, all of these things growing on it have the potential to colonize in new environments.
Then we head eastward and hear about a radical idea to restore Hetch Hetchy.
The battle to try and keep Hetch Hetchy from being destroyed was the defining moment in the National Park Service.
And we'll see what we can learn from the trees that surround us.
We, you know, live here, we die, but often trees stay, and they've seen so much that has happened around us.
Learning from nature today on Cross Currents. In our state, we're blessed with many things: mild weather most of the time, incredible scenery, microclimates, and water. Lots and lots of water, whether it's the massive Pacific, the powerful rivers, or the glistening bays. And if you look over San Francisco Bay on a clear, sunny day, you'll see sailboats, fishermen, kayakers. Under the water, there's a whole nother world of living organisms native to the bay, but also hundreds of tiny exotic organisms that now live there too, some that don't necessarily belong here. And state officials recently added four more of these alien bay invaders to the list. Julia Scott reports.
Take a trip to the bottom of San Francisco Bay, and you'd find a lot of critters that aren't supposed to be here at all, according to scientist Chris Brown.
It's unfortunately on the rarer side to find those things that should be here.
Brown is a biologist with the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center based in Marin. His lab works to locate and identify foreign marine life, which is why he's standing here at the San Francisco Marina, surrounded by sailboats. Brown says the bay is like an underwater zoo with species from all over the world. To illustrate, he pulls up a rope attached to a piece of plastic that's been sitting on the bay floor, growing species like a rock.
And so here you can see lots of different little barnacles growing on it, possibly Amphibalanus eburneus, the introduced acorn barnacle.
Earlier this year, the Department of Fish and Game's Marine Invasive Species Program announced that four new exotic aquatic species had been identified in San Francisco Bay. The acorn barnacle was one of them.
You can see this little bright orange blob here. This is a colonial tunicate, actually from the east coast of the United States as well.
DNA experts at the Moss Landing Marine Laboratory's genomics lab identified some of these new species, which include a tiny shrimp from Japan, an acorn barnacle from the North Atlantic Ocean, red algae native to Korea, and a little worm that was first found in San Diego Bay 12 years ago. With these new species, no one really knows what the effects will be. It's too early to tell whether they may turn out to be as destructive as the quagga mussel, which clogs intake pipes along the Colorado River aqueduct and has cost water agencies millions of dollars to remove, or the Asian clam, which has been partly blamed for the decline of Delta smelt. One species has raised some red flags, says Randy Emai, environmental program manager with the Department of Fish and Game.
The most worrisome, of course, is the red algae. It can reproduce quickly, and it can spread quickly like a weed. And it competes for light and space with native population of marine algae, plants, and animals.
San Francisco Bay is already one of the most invaded estuaries in the world, with at least 280 foreign species here already. Emai says four more may not make much of a difference. The bigger issue is that officials can't seem to stop the migration, and that's because these animals are stowaways. Chris Brown.
You can see this boat that we're right next to here is literally covered from bow to stern with mussels and algae and everything else that you find here on the docks.
Most foreign invaders get here by hitching a ride on the hulls of yachts and cargo vessels. Then they work their way up the coast with the shipping traffic.
And if this boat travels to another location, all of these things growing on it have the potential to colonize in new environments.
California leads the country with strict new rules on filtering ballast water ships pick up at sea, water that often carries foreign species from other ports of call. But there are no regulations pertaining to the hulls themselves, which can be very hard to clean. That's why Chris Brown believes more species than we know of may have already snuck in the back door, though he may not find them right away. And once they join the party, they're usually here to stay. In San Francisco, I'm Julia Scott for Cross Currents.
This story was produced in collaboration with KUSP Radio in Santa Cruz and was made possible by a grant from the Michael Lee Environmental Foundation. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now we'll go from discovering what's under the water to controlling its flow. This past Leap Day, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that would affect our water here in California. If it passes the Senate, the Sacramento-San Joaquin Valley Water Reliability Act would significantly revise a plan to restore the San Joaquin River and increase the water flowing to the farmlands south of the San Joaquin River Valley. Another valley, the Hetch Hetchy, is currently underwater, water that travels by gravity 160 miles to come right out of our taps here in San Francisco. 85% of the city's water comes from the reservoir, but it wasn't always this simple. Before the Hetch Hetchy Valley was flooded or the O'Shaughnessy Dam was built, environmentalists led by John Muir put up a big fight to keep it protected. Here's an excerpt from an article written by John Muir describing the Hetch Hetchy Valley.
It is a wonderfully exact counterpart of the Great Yosemite, not only in its crystal river and sublime rocks and waterfalls, but in the gardens, groves, and meadows of its flower park-like floor. The floor of Yosemite is about 4,000 feet above the sea, the Hetch Hetchy floor about 3,700. The walls of both are of gray granite, rise abruptly out of the flowery grass. And groves are sculptured in the same style, and in both, every rock is a glacial monument.
Those are the words of John Muir as read by KALW's David Latulippe. One man who shares Muir's vision is Mike Marshall. He's the executive director of Restore Hetch Hetchy, an environmental group that wants to drain the reservoir and return the valley to its natural state. Marshall sat down with KALW's Martina Castro, who asked him to go back to the early 1900s and describe the time when building the reservoir was a hotly debated radical idea.
The argument over whether Hetch Hetchy should be dammed and flooded was the first national environmental debate in the country, really. The national parks were first created when Yosemite was created as a national park in 1890, but they didn't have any money, they didn't have any definition, there were sheep herders there and loggers and all sort of stuff going on. And John Muir and others really fought to create some structure to it, but the battle to try and keep Hetch Hetchy from being destroyed was the defining moment in the National Park Service. As even though they lost the battle to protect Hetch Hetchy, the Park Service was created out of it. The Organic Act was passed. You will not find another national park with a reservoir and dam in the middle of it because of the fight to keep Hetch Hetchy from happening. So it was, and you know, the U.S. Senate debated it for a week. Wouldn't it be great if the U.S. Senate would debate things for a week today? It was a huge national debate that was lost, but in 1913. It then took about 20 years to construct the Hetch Hetchy system. They clear-cut the valley floor. They built a railroad to go into Hetch Hetchy Valley in order to bring in all the supplies to build the dam and to take the timber out. Unfortunately, what they didn't do is the corridor, the Tuolumne River corridor, was the primary human corridor for thousands of years. Native Americans that were going from the east side of the Sierras to the west side of the Sierras followed along the Tuolumne River. As a result, Hetch Hetchy Valley was a very spiritual place, and it was home to burial grounds for a number of different Native American tribes. There was no effort whatsoever made to remove those remains or to protect those remains or those cultural sites. And today, it is expected that in the sediment behind the dam, which most dams have some sediment, very little at Hetch Hetchy because it's a big granite bowl, but that there's generations upon generations of Native Americans interred at the bottom of the reservoir. The dam was constructed, and they finally started delivering water to San Francisco in 1930. And as a result, if you look at sort of where San Francisco got its water before that, versus all of a sudden there was this water from the High Sierra, we abandoned all local groundwater use. We used to recycle water back then. San Francisco no longer recycles any water. Whereas today, Orange County, 20% of the water you get out of the tap is recycled. San Francisco, as a result of having this federally subsidized water from the High Sierra, didn't develop any sustainable water management practices. And we're going to pay for that as climate change becomes a much bigger issue.
So the biggest question on people's minds is, where will San Francisco get its water? And also, there's a lot of electric power coming out of maybe not the dam itself, but hydroelectric stations. And so power and water are in people's minds when they think of getting rid of the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. What do you say to that?
So the first question is, where will we get our water? And my response to that is the exact same place. Hetch Hetchy is not the source of our water. The Tuolumne River, which flows through Hetch Hetchy Valley, is the source of our water. San Francisco's water rights are tied to the Tuolumne River, not to Hetch Hetchy Valley. So all we're saying is, let's not store our water in a national park. Let's continue to use Tuolumne River water, although let's reduce the use of it. Let's get better. Let's get more modern in terms of how we manage our water resources. But we will still be able to get the most of our water from the Tuolumne River. We just need to store it elsewhere, outside of the park. In terms of the power issue, the system itself delivers 20% of San Francisco's power, but understand that's a really small fraction of the total power produced in California. San Francisco sells surplus power to Turlock and Modesto. That's the power that will be lost. And that's not a bad thing, because they currently use that power to subsidize water to agribusiness, which is not environmentally friendly either. So there will be a 20% loss of power produced, but not in any loss of power delivered to San Francisco. It's loss of power being sold to the big farms in the Central Valley.
I'm talking to Mike Marshall, Executive Director of Restore Hetch Hetchy. So on your website, I was looking it over, and you do have a plan.
It's really not our plan per se, but the state of California has looked at this issue. The National Park System has looked at this. The Federal Bureau of Reclamation, the University of California, Davis, the Environmental Defense Fund, one of the preeminent environmental organizations in the country, they've all studied the issue and have concluded San Francisco will not be harmed by moving the reservoir out of the national park.
So what will it look like? Take me step by step.
Right.
What would it look like to actually do something like this?
There are several plans. There's one by the University of Wisconsin on our website that suggests an adaptive restoration strategy. So that's where you control the draining of the reservoir, not just because you can't dump it all at once, but so you can control the non-native species from coming in, and you can facilitate the reintroduction of plant life systematically as the water comes down to the valley floor. The river itself will reclaim itself along its regular contours pretty quickly. At which point, 18 months later, depending on the season that it finally happens, you'll start to see green meadows return to the valley floor. Within 5 to 10 years, you'll start to see saplings coming up. Now, obviously, if we do an adaptive restoration strategy, that's just on its own, Mother Nature taking its course. If we work to facilitate it and come in and have students and professors and restoration scientists, facilitating the process, you'll see within 10 to 15 years, you can camp there. The opportunity, the collateral impact of bringing this valley in Yosemite National Park, this iconic place that people from around the world travel to, it will have a huge collateral impact on other environmental restoration projects that are not as visible as the restoration of Hetch Hetchy will.
Why are people against this idea?
Well, I think our recent polling would indicate that the average person in San Francisco mistakenly believes their water comes from Hetch Hetchy, and 80% of them can't identify the Tuolumne River as the source of their water. And then it's the status quo. And the bureaucracies are designed to deliver and to protect the status quo. And I would argue that the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission is a great set of folks over there, but on a collective level, it's not their job necessarily to have the vision for the future. It's their job to deliver water and power to you and me today as cheaply and as efficiently as possible. If you look at a spreadsheet, environmental change requires resources. and a reallocation of resources. And so if you're just looking at a cost-benefit analysis on a month-by-month basis, making investments in environmental change, environmental improvements, are never going to cost out at the on the bottom line. We have a lot of decisions we have to make, and you could argue that they're hard decisions relative to the impacts that climate change are going to have on us. And we need public policy that addresses that, and we need to change our personal behavior. And this is a great confluence of it. It's about water. It's not just about Yosemite, or it's not just about Hetch Hetchy Valley. It's about how you and I use our water in the morning and how we receive our water and what kind of water that is. And so I think, you know, there are so many collateral benefits to provoking this conversation that it's as much about the conversation as it is about the outcome. But don't get me wrong, we're going to win.
Mike Marshall is executive director of Restore Hetch Hetchy. He spoke with KALW's Martina Castro. So what do you think of Marshall's idea to restore the Hetch Hetchy? Or do you have a radical idea of your own? Let us know on our Facebook page. We are KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Whether it's water or greenery, sometimes humans aren't that appreciative of nature. We go to parks, sit under shady trees. But when's the last time you truly took a moment to appreciate the trees in your life? The new Dr. Seuss film, The Lorax, imagines a world with no flowers and no trees, where everything is made of plastic. In the film, little Ted goes in search of what once was.
So, Mom, do you happen to know if there's, like, any place where I could get a real tree?
Okay, a world with fake trees made of pink and orange cotton may seem a far cry from reality, but the message is clear, and it's about preservation of our green spaces. That's also the topic of the latest exhibit at the Contemporary Jewish Museum called Do Not Destroy. It's inspired by a minor holiday on the Jewish calendar called Tu Bishvat, a kind of Jewish Earth Day, and it's all about trees. Sure, these trees are indoors, and most of them aren't real, but as KALW's Judy Silber tells us, sometimes it takes a replica to make us appreciate the real thing.
At a Berkeley City farm called Urban Adama, about 100 people are gathered under a large, white, open-air tent. It's a cold, rainy evening in early February. But never mind the weather. This is a festive occasion. Pomegranates, olives, and other fruits and wines fill the tables to celebrate a little-known Jewish holiday called Tu Bishvat. Tu Bishvat is the new year for trees, and it takes place on the 15th day of the Hebrew month of Shvat, which is January or February, depending on the year. In ancient times, this day had practical meaning. The Torah commanded the Israelites not to harvest fruit for 3 years after planting, and trees planted before Tu Bishvat were considered 1 year old on that day. In the 16th and 17th centuries, Kabbalist mystics revived Tu Bishvat. They added festive customs imbued with spirituality. About 100 years ago, the holiday became a day of tree planting, especially in Israel. More recently, Jewish environmentalists embraced it as a way of appreciating, connecting with, and caring for the earth. And celebrations like that at Urban Adama are increasingly popular.
In the past few years, we've really noticed this new interest in the holiday of Tu Bishvat.
Dara Solomon is the curator at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. Every few years, the museum invites artists to create new pieces around a holiday theme. This year is the ninth such exhibit, and Solomon met me at the museum recently to discuss it.
We had sort of run out of Jewish holidays. Last time we did the Seder plate.
That's a special plate with symbolic foods for Passover.
Before that, we did the spice box.
For the ending of Shabbat, which is the Jewish day of rest.
So we've done the more expected and a little bit of the more unusual rituals.
And she says the growing popularity of Tu B'Shvat convinced the museum that the holiday was worth an exhibit. They chose the title Do Not Destroy, a nod to a Bible verse that forbids the destruction of trees during wartime.
When in your war against the city, you have to besiege it a long time in order to capture it. Do not destroy its trees, wielding the axe against them. You may eat of them, but you must not cut them down.
Solomon and I begin walking through the exhibit. We see, well, trees of all kinds. There's a large painting of a fallen trunk, a photograph of an upside-down oak, a mythical depiction of a German birch forest. High on a monitor, a video camera's lens stays fixed on the top of a chestnut tree whose leaves wave softly in the wind. It's a piece by artist Jason Lazarus. Anne Frank wrote about this tree, which she could see from her hiding place in an Amsterdam attic during World War II. Solomon says that tree was a witness to history, as are all the trees that surround us every day.
We, you know, live here, we die, but often trees stay, and they've seen so much that has happened around us. This is a really fun piece with the gold bars that we're walking towards.
We're now in the second part of the show. It showcases pieces from 50 artists who were invited to create new works from reclaimed wood.
It's by Luc Bartels.
He's a San Francisco artist.
And here he's making a comment on our overvaluation of gold and our undervalue for wood. He's created a series of wood blocks that are in the form of gold bars.
Stacked in the shape of a pyramid.
Each one is stamped with the words pure wood.
It's a commentary, the artist says, on the way we assign values to commodities.
Now we're standing in front of a work by a Portuguese artist named Gabriela Albergaria. And this piece that takes up an enormous corner of the gallery is created out of two trees.
The trees were cut down from Golden Gate Park. Looking at them now, I wonder how many people walked by without ever noticing how truly incredible they are. In the museum, you can't help but notice. You're meant to look at their thick, twisting branches weaving upward toward the sky. I think of the children's book by Shel Silverstein, The Giving Tree.
Once there was a tree, and she loved a little boy. And every day, the boy would come, and he would gather her leaves and make them into crowns and play king of the forest.
The boy grows up. When he needs money, the tree tells him to sell her apples. When he needs a house, she instructs him to cut down her branches. And when he's old and needs a place to rest, she invites him to sit on her stump. The story is a reminder that trees stand for life, giving, and serenity. The works in Do Not Destroy ask us if these are values we want to preserve. In San Francisco, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents.
Do Not Destroy will be at San Francisco's Contemporary Jewish Museum through May 28th. For more information, you can go to our website, kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Last month on the show, we aired a piece about the controversy over how UC Berkeley is a center for unearthing and studying the remains of Native Californians.
So it's a holistic study, just like a crime scene investigation, except these are very cold cases with very ancient evidence.
Native peoples tend to believe that we know our own history and that we don't need the archaeologists or the physical anthropologists to use their ways of knowing to validate our ways of knowing.
Those were the voices of UC Berkeley professor Tim White and SF State professor Clayton Dumont expressing their views on the study of Native remains. Well, we wanted to know what you thought, and a few of you called in. This first listener, who calls himself Shadesh, had this to say.
I am a Native American, and I believe that Native bones should be researched and studied only and when all people are that of all races are studied. So if we are allowed to go into the tombs of the Catholic Church, go underneath the tombs of all churches and look at their bones and study them as well, then it'd be a fair and equitable thing to do. Until that happens, one small group should not be singled out for a study.
Next message.
Hi, my name is Ron Cantrell, and I think it's the most ridiculous thing in the world. These people don't even know anything about the people that they want to save the get the bones from. They don't want anybody to study the bones. It's ridiculous. That's for all of us. That's for all of humanity to know what's going on. It doesn't belong to any little tribe to hold on to in a petty fashion. So I can't be strongly for the university saving the bones.
End of new messages.
And if you'd like to share your thoughts on any of our stories, you can call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, RTM's Konohovs, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. Instead of an Irish band for St. Patrick's Day, we're suggesting the island rhythm rock of The Band Sage, which you're hearing now. They'll be singing and swaying at 19 Broadway in Fairfax on Saturday night, and it's still okay to wear green. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Fortune, I wonder what I wait for. It's got me locked down one song. I really want to hear more. Now I make you feel so small.